Stunned silence.
What is this?
A bit of a side.
So it must be doing something.
Kind of playing this thing.
Tell us what you're doing.
I just can't think of it.
I love the enthusiasm.
Brilliant.
You're tuned to the 15th Station, New Zealand's first Catholic podcast. This is episode 118 for August 15th, 2017. That makes it the Feast of the Assumption, which makes it our 10th birthday. 10 years we've been doing this podcast. And the dulcet tones you hear there are the one and only Gavin. How are you, Gavin?
Good, thanks, James. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Double digits.
Do we say happy anniversary?
Yeah, I don't know what
happy
we say.
Happy anniversary, but... happy birthday. Yeah. You know, it's one of those things. We've also got the lovely Anna. How are you, Anna?
I'm well, thank you, James. Good to be here.
Great to have you here. And we did have the Don, but unfortunately he's had some technical issues involving his golf game. So that's dropped about. we welcome back Gabes. How are you, Gabes?
Good, James. How are you?
Good, mate. It's been a while since we've been on the podcast. I mean, we're trying to figure it out. I think it's about 18 months. But it is probably a lot sooner since we've had our other guest today returning after, we reckon, six-something years. George. Welcome, George. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm very well, thank you. It's good to be here.
It's great to talk to you. And we did have a few other guests that were looking to try and drop in, and it didn't look like it was going to all work out, but I know we're going to have a bunch of people listening on this 10-year anniversary episode. It was 10 years ago, Gavin, almost to the day, I actually think, when I'm looking at the day we were recording it, where we were clustered around that clustered around a microphone and an old laptop in a room at the Pompalia Diocesan Centre here in Auckland. And it would be fair to say that room, in addition to lacking volume, lacked air conditioning. And I seem to remember feeling quite warm.
I'm glad it was August.
Can you imagine if it had been the middle of summer? Do you remember much about that fateful night?
I just remember that we were busy trying to find the smallest room we could find, because we thought, okay, we're here around this, you know, spacious room that we had arranged to have it, and you're like, yeah, this is not going to work. This is an example of how prepared I was for the world of podcasting. I found this really good room. It's really quiet, and you're like, yes, it's cavernous.
Yeah.
It's going to echo like we're in a cave. So then we found the smallest room we could, like it was a tornado or something, and we had to get into the smallest room in the house to protect ourselves. And Gabe was there. Gabe was there, right?
That's right. I was there.
Brendan. And then we're a lot. Then here we are, 10 years later. The wonders of Skype.
The wonders of Skype, which I must admit I've spent the last half hour cursing. So apologies if the audio quality isn't quite as good as it would be. I have to say the audio quality, you can tell when I've been the one involved with the technical production as opposed to Joseph, who for many of the back catalogue, the quality is far superior to what we managed today. But here we are, we soldier on 10 years later, still trying to cover off the Catholic news of the day. So we'll get into it. We have got a really interesting show lineup today. So we'll talk through the stories, and then maybe there's some time to reminisce at the end as well. But we'll get into the serious stuff first. This is from the Catholic News Agency. A long-term inquiry submitted to New Zealand's Parliament did not recommend that assisted suicide and euthanasia be legalised in the country. We've tried to distill all the arguments, and our recommendations to both the Parliament and the people of New Zealand is to read this report and come to a deeper understanding of what's being asked around assisted suicide and euthanasia, Simon O'Connor, the chair of the Parliament's Health Committee, said which prepared the report, said on the 2nd of August. The report, which was an investigation of euthanasia and assisted suicide and attitudes towards them, prompted by a request from a former New Zealand Labour Party MP and assisted suicide advocate, Mary-Ann Street. A bill to legalise voluntary euthanasia has been introduced in the New Zealand Parliament, but it is unlikely to be passed before the end of the legislature's term later this month, according to the New Zealand Herald. Having faced moral opponents and concerns about safeguards in the past, euthanasia bills have previously failed in the country. The effort was renewed, however, in 2014 after a Wellington lawyer's battle with brain cancer gained political and media attention. Lucretia Seals had petitioned New Zealand's High Court for the right to assisted suicide and died from her cancer. Street introduced a petition in favour of legalising assisted suicide shortly after. The Health Committee's subsequent inquiry heard from some 22,000 submitters, 80% of whom were opposed to a change in legislation that would allow for assisted suicide and euthanasia. Quote, but I don't think this is simply a numbers game. It is about actually understanding the arguments for and against and making a decision about which ones are correct, O'Connor said. It's a pretty heavy story to start the lineup, Gavin, but a pretty important one as well. What did you make of this this recommendation that came back from the parliamentary subcommittee?
Well, yeah, it was interesting to hear the magnitude of the submissions against it. And Simon O'Connor is correct. I think he's a former seminarian, actually, but he is correct to say that this isn't a numbers game. And I think if you would have guessed what the numbers would have said, you probably would have guessed it might have been 80% the other way, because it's one of, we'll have another issue later in the show where we talk about numbers and social issues and support for same. So it was interesting. Obviously, there was a good effort put in by some of the people who are concerned about the dangers of euthanasia and assisted suicide, and they put their case forward. And it's curious it sort of comes back and just say, well, here's a report, have a read and see what you think, without sort of recommending it shouldn't become legislation, or recommending that it does become legislation. But I think what it appears to do is provide a framework for ongoing debate. I think we would expect that this will be, we know that the New Zealand election, or those are new listeners, in September, New Zealand will have its next national elections, and probably in the life of the next parliament over the next 3 years, someone else will probably renew this discussion. So this provides a bit of a framework, I think, for ongoing conversations about it, and hopefully does allow people to recognise some of the dangers that in Australia, there's a couple, at least two or three states that are looking at going down this path as well. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens here. So certainly in the West, it continues to be an issue that's of great interest to a lot of people. And maybe even an international context, given the nature and the scale of the submissions that were made to the New Zealand Inquiry, it might become a bit of a guiding document for some others as well. So kudos to them for doing a pretty good piece of work at the behest of someone else, but and providing this document that can be a source of reflection.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you talk about the international context. I mean, George, you know, up in Europe, there are obviously countries where euthanasia and assisted suicide are legal. I mean, the Netherlands comes to mind. But were you following this? Obviously, you're not in New Zealand at the moment, but were you following this? What was going on, and did you have any thoughts about what the committee was reporting back?
I vaguely heard of it, and so actually, when I was in New Zealand at around the time that people were asked to submit, so I actually did submit on the issue. I actually haven't followed since. I mean, I saw the headlines that it had come through of what was said, and I thought that was great. I was so surprised. I felt like being in Europe, it feels like everything is pro-euthanasia, like most things that you read, and it's really common. So I was so pleasantly surprised when I saw that that was what came out of the submissions.
Yeah. Gabe, so what about yourself? I mean, are you on the same book as the rest of us in terms of, if someone had said to me the result was 80%, I would have said yeah, in favour, because you think that when you read through all of the mainstream coverage, and it is such a difficult issue to legislate on. But what were your thoughts when you heard this result?
Yeah, I was quite surprised, actually, because New Zealanders, I think we like to pride ourselves on being the first in the world to do lots of stuff. Well, we won't be first now, but be more progressive, I suppose. So it was a bit of a surprise. Although, what does this mean in the big... The bill's actually still before Parliament, yeah? Or it's in process. So this is just a document recommending whether or not it should go ahead, or...
Essentially, I mean, so the Parliament is about to dissolve before the election, so there's not going to be time to debate it. So there's not going to be anything legislated, and, you know, the article does say that there's the possibility, and it's unlikely, or whatever the term was that James read from. But and once the Parliament comes to an end, sort of everything gets tossed out and you have to start again. So my expectation is that someone will renew the process, or either this piece of legislation will be adopted by a politician, or my hunch would be that someone who is a supporter of euthanasia or assisted suicide will reflect quite deeply on what's in the document and then possibly look to amend whatever current wording exists for legislation and try and craft it in such a way that makes it more likely to be successful. So that'll be my expectation of how it might unfold.
Right, so it doesn't pull it entirely, but it sort of introduces a few more discussion points or sticking points.
Yeah, so as often happens when legislation is proposed to the parliament, it's sent to a select committee that'll do a pretty thorough process, go through a thorough process to hear the views of the public, and that's sort of what this has been on this issue. And then, yeah, once parliament dissolves, the bill itself will sort of die with it, and it's probably not the right term, but given the topic. But someone will renew it either in the same form or in a new form.
Is there any analysis of what the 80% dissenters were, or sort of what the makeup was? Or was it professionals? Or was it religious?
Well, I haven't read the review, I must confess. But I suspect if you sought the review and had a read of it, you'd get some deeper insights into, or even there's be a lot more coverage than the story we've provided, but that can give people some insights into some of the key objections that people put forward. And I can look to include that in the show notes probably.
Yeah, put it in there. Because, Anna, I guess that call to sort of read through what has been recommended and I guess generally engage more with this as a topic, that is probably a good call, given it is such a contentious and emotional topic for so many people, of course. I mean, what were your sort of thoughts when you heard about this?
It's good that this has been done without the pressure of, like a bill trying to be pushed through. We've had a couple of years of, you made submissions a little while ago and there was time for a report to be drafted that could potentially be something that helps all New Zealanders come and understand what this law the law change would actually mean. I think it's been a positive thing in that sense. And although 80% are opposed to a change, it also sort of brings up or highlights that palliative care and hospice care and things like that perhaps need to be more robust. And, so it probably highlights some failings we have in caring for those who are terminally ill and things like that. And so that's a good thing, I think. If we can build that area of our health service, then, perhaps people are going to feel more safe or looked after if they are to become terminally ill or something like that. So I think it's good. I think it's positive.
It's good to sort of see some the debate continuing and not just being one-sided, which I think a few of us feared. So as always, it is one of those things where it is very emotional and personal for people, especially those who've had to watch loved ones suffer. But I think that when you do look at the international case studies and look at the countries that have moved ahead and legislated on such matters, some of them just regret it because of what you start seeing coming through. We'll move on because this many panelists. We haven't had this many panelists for a while. It will take us a while here all night. The next article is a really positive one, actually. This one's from stuff.co.nz. Alistair Castillo tried to fight the call to become a priest, but God was a, quote, nagger. It's that very annoying nagging that's kind of like when your parents are telling you to do the dishes. They keep... Sorry, I haven't quite heard a call to a vocation described as being like when your parents tell you to go to the dishes. They keep telling you and you kind of know you have to do it, end quote. Last month, a 27-year-old Christchurch man became the Catholic Diocese of Christchurch, but what the Catholic Diocese of Christchurch believes to be the youngest priest in New Zealand. He and Graham Blackburn, 33, and Huing Tran, 31, apologise if I got your name wrong there, committed to serve God in front of a congregation of 600 and about 60 other priests. The celebration was rare for the, diocese, with three ordained in 2015, but the most recent before that happening 10 years earlier, Bishop's Pastoral Office Director Mike Stopforth said. It also came as a religion in New Zealand declines overall. Catholics overtook Anglicans as the largest religion in 2006, but the overall number dropped from more than 508,000 in 2006 to 492,000 in 2013. Blackburn said that priesthood was quite a foreign concept to friends when he told them about his decision about 7 years ago. Quote, the people who you get on with really well, they might struggle to see why you've picked this lifestyle, because it is quite a lifestyle, he said. But all were supportive of his choice, and he had become closer with many of them, he said. While numbers were declining in New Zealand, seminaries are having to turn people away in countries like Vietnam, Stopforth said. That was how Tran found his way into priesthood in Christchurch. Stopforth said Bishop Barry Jones invited Tran about 9 years ago to learn English before going into the seminary. Quote, in the West, we've got a declining number of priests, but in Vietnam, they have hundreds of guys who can't get into the seminary because they're just full. Well, that's a pretty good problem to have, don't you think, George, having seminaries that are too full and you have to turn people away? You're getting a 27-year-old to come in and be a priest in New Zealand. That's got to be pretty good, don't you think?
It was fabulous if we had that in New Zealand, packed seminaries.
Yeah, I mean, I know we've definitely had an increase in numbers, and Anna, you have some involvement with some of the priests in training, so this is great news to sort of see these guys get to the final stage and take their holy orders.
Yeah, it is wonderful, and I was pretty gutted that I couldn't be at the ordination, but I think they actually streamed it live on YouTube, which was really amazing. So the three guys who were ordained this year and the three who were ordained a couple of years ago are just really great. It's really positive to have new young priests, and they're intelligent. They are faithful men, and it's a real gift for the Church of New Zealand, even though they're obviously based in Christchurch, but it is a real gift, so it's great.
Gabe, you're not going to hold that they're based in Christchurch against them, are you? That they can't have?
Is Christchurch even part of New Zealand? I think my parents actually went to this ordination ceremony, actually.
Yeah, and what was their review?
I have yet to ask them, but I imagine it would be glowing.
Yes. 3.5 stars.
Yeah, 2 thumbs up, must see again.
Yeah, must see again, yes, definitely. But no, it's definitely good news. You do tend to see not a lot of young priests around the Auckland diocese, so it's definitely good to see a lot of young ones coming through.
Yeah, it is good. I mean, Gavin, I'm not sure what the situation is in Sydney in terms of average age of priests, but this has got to be good news, I think, all round, isn't it?
Yeah, there seems to be... I don't know if we've got the empirical evidence in New Zealand, but I think there's certainly a suggestion that in the post-World Youth Day years, in terms of World Youth Day Sydney in 2008, that Australia has enjoyed a bit of a flourishing of seminarians and some of them now having been ordained in the last couple of years, the class of World Youth Day, if you will. And I think in New Zealand there's a sense that might have had some impact as well. Anna may have more insights into that, but certainly when, you know, a large number of New Zealanders came to World Youth, it was at 4,000 or something in 2008, and normally about 100 go. So there was an opportunity for young men to see the church in all its glory, for lack of a better term, at World Youth Day, and that seems to have certainly inspired some men to answer the call to respond to the nagging and put the rubber gloves on and do the dishes and enter the seminary and now be ordained in the case of these three young men. So certainly there's some full seminaries in Australia at the moment in different parts of the country. So there are, what do they call them, green shoots? Was that the term?
Green shoots.
Yeah.
Green shoots of a new harvest. So I think that's something, it's great news.
It's almost scriptural.
It almost. I'm sure. In fact, I'm pretty sure it is scriptural. I think I hope that Father Tran and Father, hang on a second, sorry, I scrolled down.
Blackburn,
thank you. Father Castillo. Castillo. Probably. We wish you all the very best in your ministry. Thank you very much for your service. And
please promote our podcast in your parish.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Promote it in there, and hopefully we can encourage some respectful debate, which is exactly what this next story from the Bendigo Advertiser, that well-known publication.
10 years, it's finally made it.
Onto the 15th station, so it's having its day in the sun. Bendigo's most senior Catholic has called for a respectful debate on same-sex marriage, but says changing the Marriage Act would have deeper effects. Bishop of Sandhurst, Les Tomlinson, released a statement on Thursday blaming both sides of the debate for relying on emotional and sometimes disrespectful arguments, while reiterating the Church's opposition to same-sex marriage. Bishop Tomlinson pointed to a document from the Catholic Bishops of Australia that says marriage equality would, quote, destabilise marriage further, and that same-sex relationships were, quote, very different to heterosexual relationships. The document is titled Don't Mess with Marriage. Bishop Tomlinson said the Catholic Church's first concern was for the well-being of all people. Quote, while our definition and teaching on marriage is well known, indeed our view has been clearly defined for almost 2,000 years, our view is that each person, regardless of their ethnicity, creed, gender, sexuality, age, or ability, is worthy of dignity and respect, he wrote. As the secular society seeks to answer the question as to whether it redefines marriage, I pray that we treat each other with respect and not resort to emotive or insulting language or behavior. By restricting ourselves to emotional arguments, we ignored exploring the deeper effects of changing the definition and restrict ourselves to a superficial level of debate. Postal ballots will be mailed to registered voters across Australia in the coming weeks. The result is non-binding and will cost taxpayers $122 million. My surprise and emphasis added. In 2004, former Prime Minister John Howard took less than an hour to draft legislation banning same-sex couples from marrying. $122 million, Gavin. You're an Australian taxpayer now. How's this going down in the Great Sunburnt Land?
Not very well. That's probably the briefest description I can offer. So, as you just alluded to there, so back in 2004, the then Prime Minister John Howard and his government changed the, well, I think much of the opposition, if not all of it, as there was sort of this growing impetus around certain parts of the world for same-sex marriage. What had been known to be the intent of the existing Marriage Act in Australia, that marriage is between two persons and would be between a man and a woman, it became enshrined in law that marriage was indeed between a man and a woman, I guess as a way to try and head off at the pass potential moves in the future. And here we are, you know, more than a decade later, and there have been some legislative attempts. So people are trying to, supporters of same-sex marriage trying to introduce legislation in the Parliament in Australia, unsuccessfully in terms of having it become law. And before the last election, which was just over 12 months ago, the sitting government said that their plan was to, after the election, have what's known as a plebiscite, which is essentially like a referendum, if you will. So there are technical differences between them, but essentially that everyone would be called to the polls, go, and everyone in Australia is compulsory voting, so people would go and vote on whether they wanted to support same-sex marriage or not. The other parties, and because the government doesn't have the majority in both houses of parliament, the government was unable to get that supported. So now they've come up with a sort of a middle ground in this idea of a postal plebiscite. So apparently the other plebiscite, if it was a in-person vote like a normal election, it was going to cost $160 million. So this is cheaper, if you want to look at it from a financial perspective. But I think the overwhelming view of most people is the job of Parliament is to make law or not make law, depending on their view. And it isn't the, you know, all those years ago, the Marriage Act was changed very easily. Why are we now in Australia going to be spending all this money to make a decision that parliamentarians should really be making? There are a number of people who have legislation that they want to introduce, introduce it, let people have a vote, all the parliamentarians, and then let the chips fall where they may. But the government is sort of digging its toes and saying, well, we said we were going to proceed this way and that's how we're going to proceed. And you've got people saying it's too important to be left just to 226 parliamentarians. And then you've got other people saying, well, you guys decide, or often it's just the Prime Minister, decide to take us into Iraq, or you decide to put up taxes, or you decide to do all manner of things without consulting the public on. So why is it that this is an issue of such importance to do that? So I think overwhelmingly there's a sense of disappointment that this is going to be how it happens. There are some people who are supportive, because I think, you know, I don't think it'd be any surprise that most people expect that the tide would be in favour of same-sex marriage, as it is in most countries in the West. So there are people who are supporters of traditional marriage, including the bishops, who would be hoping that it isn't successful and that the traditional understanding of marriage remains. But I think there are some people who think that doing it this way could lead to a no vote. And there's a lot of talk about, well, should we boycott it because this shouldn't be how we're doing it, and therefore that could increase the proportion of people who vote to retain traditional marriage, and then that would skew the result. And it's a bit of a mess.
It's a bit of a mess, mate, right? And $122 million for a non-binding decision, I can see why there'd be a fair few Australians not too pleased with it. I mean, I guess looking at it from our side of things, where it is legal here in terms of same-sex marriage, George, do you think, I mean, the situation in Europe is obviously different in different countries as well, but is it seen as an inevitability, the tide that is sort of sweeping the world in terms of this redefinition of marriage?
I haven't really discussed this with many people, but from just living in the UK, I mean, it's legal here and it's just such a normal thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not even debated. I mean, I work with a couple of homosexual people, and they're married to their partners, and, you know, it's just a normal, it's not even debated. It's just how life is here. I mean, this is in the UK. I can't speak for all of Europe, but
Well, you can. You can speak for all of Europe if you like.
I can, but I don't have any authority.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But I mean, it's yeah, my personal gut feel is that it kind of is an inevitability. It just feels like most people I would come into contact with would see it as a non-issue. Of course, why wouldn't you have it?
Mm.
And if you sort of try and explain why you might be opposed to that, you sort of looked at as a bit of a crazy person.
And I mean, I think this is something, I mean, we've talked about it over the years on the podcast, Anna, and I think that it's one of those things where it is sort of seen as somewhat inevitable. But I guess this is also, well, I mean, it's up to Australia to decide for themselves. But what's your thoughts? Do you think even if this comes back with a no, it's eventually going to get a yes?
I don't know. I wouldn't want to.
Speak for all of Australia? Come on.
Yeah, I don't know. But it was interesting, actually. Today I was watching a video, I think, that the Sydney Morning Herald had put out. And it was basically explaining sort of the reason why that we should have, or they, that Australia should have homosexual marriage. But it was outlining it more in a legal sense. So, you know, if you have, you know, you're in a relationship and your partner dies, if you marry, this is kind of the things that are afforded to you. And if you're not, then, you know, these are the struggles you would have. And I was kind of looking at it going, right, so it's just really been reduced to something it's just a legal matter. It's just a bit of paper, which has legal kind of ramifications. And I guess, you know, the state of marriage before homosexual marriage sort of came on the scene, the state of marriage was declining, you know, and this is just another, I guess, string to the bow of marriage declining around the world. And if marriage has just been reduced to a bit of paper, then that's going to be the result, I guess.
I think that it's a really good point, Anna, and it's sort of, I mean, Gabes, it's what with the bishop, the good bishop there, is saying that that marriage equality would, quote, destabilize marriage further. He's not saying it would destabilize marriage. I think there's an acknowledgement there that the institution of marriage over the last, you know, 100 years has fundamentally changed from where it has been for hundreds of years prior to that. And I guess that's hence why I kind of ask, is this just an inevitability? And if you were a taxpayer, would you want to spend $122 million finding out that it's inevitable?
James, I just have to say, you lost me at plebiscite. I'm pretty sure I used the word plebiscite as an insult in the past. Now, is it actually a legal term, is it?
Yeah, I think you may be referring to someone as a pleb.
Pleb. Is that not just short form of plebiscite?
If next time you got to insult someone, you're calling them a non-binding referendum vote.
Can I also point out the irony? I'm not even sure if irony is right, but of having a respectful debate in Australia. Surely that's
games.
Apologies to our Australian listeners. But to your original question, James, with what Anna was saying about how marriage has sort of been reduced to almost an afterthought, sort of it's just a thing that you do these days. And, you know, I think personally, it feels almost as if it's inevitable. But if it does open up some kind of discourse as to why, you know, why there are opposing views to the inevitable tide, then perhaps, you know, people will start respecting marriage a little bit more, respect the sacrament of, you know, matrimony a little bit more. I'm not sure, but I think we are, I wouldn't want to say trying to hold back the tide, but
I think I know what he's trying to get at. I mean, it is one of these things where we've talked about it many, many times, and I guess we'll continue to talk about it, but I just wonder when it moves from this level of redefinition to further redefinition, which I know when we had the discussion happening in New Zealand, you know, you started to see people go, oh, look, that's scaremongering and blah, blah, blah. But the reality is that once you start down a path of redefinition, why would you stop?
Yeah, I mean, there's a possibility of that. I think what I would say is that from what I've observed, you see some sort of fairly crazy things on Facebook and, you know, from international news sources from time to time. I think the reality is that to this point, Western countries haven't taken the next step. And I agree that, you know, at some point, there is a chance that there are further redefinitions. And I think at this point, we haven't seen that eventuate. But I think there's a view at the moment in Australia amongst people who are trying to rationalize this idea of, you know, there is a tide that's flowing quite swiftly, and it is inevitable. And I think even people within the current government, which sits on the conservative side of politics, there are some people within there who are trying to encourage people who are supporters of traditional marriage and say, just think about this. If this passes while we're in government, there's a better chance that we are going to put in place certain exemptions and rights that will allow freedoms to remain for those who hold to traditional marriage. If a new government comes in that's from the progressive side of politics, particularly if they happen to be in coalition with someone like the Greens, then just think about what might happen in terms of there will be no religious exemptions in a range of different areas. So that's a tactic that's being used, and I think it's probably being used quite successfully, and saying this is going to happen at some point in the next, you know, 1 to 5 years. Wouldn't you rather it be done in a way that allows religious freedoms and sensitivities to be retained? So it's a hugely complicated issue, and the bishop's right that we do want a respectful debate. At the moment, there seems to be a view from one side that if you don't support it, you're obviously a bigot. That's the only possible explanation for why you wouldn't support same-sex marriage, so which is obviously not particularly respectful and not really engaging with the issue. And equally on the other side, there are some people who are equating same-sex marriage with some pretty unsavoury parts of society. So there are certainly problems at either end of the spectrum. And I think Gabe's idea about a respectful debate happening in Australia, let's hope that the trans-Tasman rivalries between New Zealand and Australia, that maybe that somehow we can overcome that, and there can indeed be respectful debate on this issue going forward, because it's going to it's sort of going to take the next 3 months. And one of the big concerns is that there's a very acrimonious and unhelpful debate. And some people even said, you know, this is going to be of such distress that some young people might, who are LGBTI, might, you know, self-harm or even commit suicide because of some of the negative things that are going to be said over the course of the campaign. So there's a lot of unhelpful conversation coming from both ends. And I'm not sure how we can try and rise above it. But at some point the bishops are going to, because that statement that was alluded to, Don't Mess With Marriage, was released, I think, about 18 months ago when it appeared that there was going to be a push for legislation. Maybe not quite that long ago, but at some point, whether they renew that statement, which caused a lot of angst among many Catholics and non-Catholics, and whether they'll refine that or whether they'll produce a new document. But the Church will speak clearly on it, and it'll be unpopular with a large number of people, including probably something like 60% of Catholics, who most polls suggest 60 or 70% of Catholics are in favour of redefining marriage.
It'll be something which definitely, I mean, especially as you raise some of those ramifications, one can only hope that the debate is actually rational and logical and reasoned, no matter which side of the debate you sit on. Yeah, definitely don't want people harming themselves over the outcome of it, especially when I think the outcome is pretty much inevitable. But it's important that everyone takes a bit of care, I think, which is exactly what our next article is asking for as well. This is from the Catholic News Service. Denouncing the demonization of migrants, hateful rhetoric, the militarization of the border, and a system that divides family, Bishop Mark Seitz, how do you pronounce that one?
Seitz, probably.
Seitz, yeah, that'd be right, the one I didn't use, of El Paso in Texas, called on Catholics to heed the Church's teaching to welcome the migrant. In a July 18 pastoral letter, Sorrow and Mourning Flee Away, on migration, and addressed to the people of God in the Diocese of El Paso, Bishop Seitz, who serves a border community near Mexico, and the country's security, said the country's security cannot be used as a pretext to build walls and shut the door to migrants and refugees. I'm assuming that is both figurative and literally. God did not create a world lacking room for all at the banquet of life, he wrote. He said that while some might question his reflections, quote, I am not substituting politics for the teaching of the Church, but as a pastor, his duty is to the gospel of Jesus Christ, he wrote. And the gospel of the Old Testament is clear, he said. You shall treat the alien who resides with you no different than the natives born among you. Bishop Seitz also criticized a system that, quote, permits some to detain human beings for profit, while eroding the country's, quote, historic commitment to the refugee and asylum seeker. Bishop Seitz said that that even though the immigration system is broken, it has not been fixed in large part because elected leaders have not yet mustered, quote, the moral courage to enact permanent comprehensive immigration reform, migrants should not be the ones paying the price. Quote, still migrants are treated, as Pope Francis says, as pawns on the chessboard of humanity. Their labor and talents are exploited, but they are denied the protections of the law and are scapegoated for our social and economic ills, he wrote. He praised the work of border communities in welcoming the stranger and says places such as his diocese are filled with heroic individuals, families, pastors, religious, parishes and institutions that spend themselves in service to migrants and refugees feeling conflict, hunger and persecution. They also advocate for just laws and against the militarization of our border, he wrote. Pretty heavy stuff there, Gabes, don't you think? But I mean, at the same time, if you're a bishop on the border of Mexico and the States, with everything that the current president is talking about, it's probably a pretty good message for people to keep in mind about opening up and, you know, accepting people who maybe weren't born right next to you.
It is, but I guess the issue is there's quite a lot of fear, I suppose, just with the current environment. And I guess the people in charge play on that fear, perhaps. I don't know if it's fear of the unknown, fear of the illegal immigrants, fear of terrorists coming across the border. But I guess when you play on people's fears like that, I mean, at the end of the day, they're just trying to keep their families safe, right? That's the argument.
That is the argument. That is a good point. But I mean, I guess, you know, Anna, I'm sitting here in a country that ultimately, you know, 4 or 5 generations ago, my forefathers were immigrants of, and I guess for most of us that would be the case, especially out here in Australia and New Zealand. But what do you make of what the good bishop is saying?
Well, I think it's a pretty complicated situation. And migrants, yes, we should look after them, and refugees. But I guess that particular border has been, for a very long time, not just in, under the current leadership, but for a very long time, a place of crime and, I can understand the fear that is there, but then also, I don't know if it's, I don't know if it's just simple. It sounds perhaps that Bishop is speaking quite simplistically, perhaps. Yeah, I mean, we all should look after our, love our neighbour, and whoever that happens to be, whoever comes into our life. And but yeah, perhaps this context, it's difficult. It's a difficult context.
I think you summed that up beautifully, in the sense that he's speaking quite simplistically. I mean, George, he is talking about some sort of fundamental principles here. But I mean, the UK, with all the Brexit story talk and what's happening with the terrorism attacks there in the mainstream Europe, I mean, there's very, you know, there'd be people who are quite a way away from Mexico and the US who would be saying that the bishop is maybe being a little bit oversimplistic, you think?
Yeah. As Anna said, it's so complex. And one thing that I notice or think about is where I live in London, particular area, has a huge amount of immigration, I'm presuming probably since the 50s or 60s. And I'm quite an ethnic minority, and I guess religious minority where I live. And I understand why people would be sort of scared of immigration when around you, you see that you're becoming a smaller and smaller number. But also on a, and I'm not, probably going off on a tangent now, not answering the question, but just on a religious perspective, I feel like I'm such a minority in a country that used to be very Christian. Okay, so now I'm thinking about this is very tangential, so sorry. But it's just basically it's just, I see that every day, and I actually do think about that quite a lot, because I think, you know, we should definitely help people who are struggling and, or, you know, or under persecution in their country. But we never talk about the bigger picture in terms of, from a religious perspective, from the country, you know, like your, this country now is pretty much secular, really, but used to be Christian, but in the future it's probably going to become quite a strongly Muslim country, and that's something we don't talk about. It makes it a more vibrant country, people from lots of different places. But anyway, sorry, that's a complete tangent, but it's just something that we talk a lot about Brexit, and we talk a lot about terrorism and this and that, but just a general thing I've noticed is in terms of the makeup of the faiths of people does have an impact.
It does, and I think this is the point, Gavin, from me, is that it is kind of, well, it's not kind of, it is very complex. It is something which is not as black and white. I mean, we are called to, in effect, we have to kind of marry up things that can be quite paradoxical. We've got to sort of care and look out for those who are disadvantaged by war and famine and disease and politics. And at the same time, we have to not encourage the kind of violent behaviour that ends up causing said war, famine, politics. It's a bit of a tricky one, don't you think?
Clearly, it's a very difficult issue. In Australia, it's, a very hot issue. During a period of time, there were a number of people who sought to come to Australia from places like Indonesia, often further afield than that, but often Indonesia was sort of a stop on the way, and then they would try and travel here by boat and land on Australian shores and therefore be able to settle in Australia. And there were a number of deterrents put in place to try and stop that from happening. So immigration is a huge issue here, and how Australia has dealt with, I was going to say that's probably not the right word, but actually it probably is the right word, how Australia has dealt with people who have arrived by boat, some of whom would be legitimate refugees, other people who are who see an opportunity, and then there are these people, these seedy characters behind that, who are trying to encourage people and taking money from people, often people who are desperate to find a new life, and saying, well, we'll help you get to Australia. And when they get to Australia, they find that they can't settle here. So there's a lot of moving parts, a lot of complexity. I went to, just quickly, I went to a lecture the other night from an academic from the Netherlands. She's from Australia or New Zealand, but she's now a lecturer in the Netherlands at the University of Groningen or something like that. Father Roderick will be mortified with that pronunciation. But she was talking about this issue of refugees and religion and how it interacts. And she said there's sort of these three new dichotomies that have emerged. Basically, there's a view that there's a thing called good religion and a thing called bad religion. And often the idea is that Christianity is a good religion and Muslims a bad religion. And sort of a subset of that is you've got good Muslims, who are sort of the peaceful ones, and then the bad Muslims, the ones who we sort of put in this big lump of people who are terrorists or potential terrorists. And then that sort of morphed into an idea of, then you have what's called a good refugee or a bad refugee, depending on where they fit on that religion or Muslim spectrum that has been created. And she sought to, and again, I think this is a reasonably simplistic way to a conclusion to come to, but she sort of challenged those of us who were there at the lecture to say, you know, when you think of a refugee or an asylum seeker as a person, rather than sort of this sort of hypothetical group of people, it's pretty hard to come to the conclusion that that person shouldn't be welcomed into a country and given every opportunity that you can give to them. Now, like I said, I think that's a simplistic answer, but I think it's certainly a challenge to us, and I think it's what Pope Francis would say, and it's what the Bishop of El Paso was sort of saying, that, you know, these are, you know, there are people who are doing it with dangerous and scary motives. There's no question about it. But there's what they're basically saying is that's the minority, and we should be seeking to support the majority of people who aren't in that sort of camp, and reach out to them and do everything we can to support them, because that's what the gospel calls us to.
I think absolutely, and I think this is what it summarizes up to the good bishop, is that it is complicated, and I think that maybe it isn't as simple as we might like. I tell you what is simple, though. Our last story, and it's a brilliant one. It's one of my favorites after 10 years. This is brilliant. From Wales Online. Of course it's from Wales Online. 7 Catholic priests walk into a bar and get asked to leave because staff thought they were on a stag do. It may sound like the beginning of a really bad joke, but it really did happen for one cheery group of seminarians. The group was celebrating in Cardiff after Father Peter McLaren. I love it. I just love it. There's everything about this. Father Peter McLaren was ordained at the Cardiff Metropolitan Cathedral of St. David near Queen Street earlier that day. They decided to head to the City Arms to enjoy a pint or two. But once they got there, there was a slight misunderstanding. The priest said on arrival, the bartender informed them that it was policy not to grant entry to fancy dress parties or stag do's. Upon hearing this, our initial impression was that this was a joke, until it became clear that this was not the case and he was in fact serious. After insisting to no avail that they were in fact students for the priesthood, two of them having recently been ordained deacons, we turned to leave. A gentleman who they assumed to be the manager then approached them at the door and reassured us that he did accept who they claimed to be and subsequently invited us back in. By way of an apology, he then graciously provided us with a round of drinks, at which point the group decided to stay, provoking an outburst of applause from the locals casually enjoying a pint. But the soon-to-be priests continued to draw attention in the famous pub. They said throughout the afternoon, the group continued to receive a warm welcome from the regulars, but their curiosity did not cease, with many approaching us and asking us questions. I just love it. I love it on so many levels. But 7 Catholic priests walk into a bar. Well, they're not quite priests yet. I don't know what the risk of this would be in Australia, Gavin. I'd say here in New Zealand, probably not high, given that, you know, you can't really identify most of the seminarians if they walk into a pub, would you? Would you be able to tell that they're seminarians?
Not seminarians, but once they're ordained deacons, most of them are wearing a collar these days.
That's a good point.
I think there are some seminaries in Australia where, and certainly some seminaries internationally, where seminarians do wear Satans.
Right.
Kazakhs.
Yep.
So this, when I first read this, it reminded me of a of an occasion a couple of years ago when a longtime friend of the show, let's refer to them this person as, and I went for a dinner in Sydney, and he was wearing some traditional Catholic garb, and there was a fancy dress party on in that pub that night, and a couple of the people in fancy dress sought to have their photo taken with him. They did realize that he wasn't actually in fancy dress. But they thought it would be quite a nice compliment to, as in with an E in the middle, compliment to their own outfits if they had a picture of a someone who appeared to be a priest and with him. And said friend of the show didn't find it particularly amusing.
Said friend did not.
And had quite a scowl on said friend's face as the photo was taken.
Oh, so, still allowed the photo to be taken, though.
It did allow the photo to be taken, but I think probably was a bit like that, you know, when you get a family photo taken and you just can't get that one child to smile at the right time or keep your eyes open. It was sort of one of those scenarios. So it was a bit of a flashback, although he was, said friend of the show, was served dinner that evening with no concerns.
Brilliant. I love it. I love it. We've talked about some pretty interesting stories over the last 10 years, I think, team. If I think back, and I might even try and splice in some of the first ever episode with all its horrendous audio quality. But 10 years ago, we were in that room and we were recording. I think on the first night, on that first podcast, in addition to trying to explain what a podcast was, I'm trying to think what I actually said on it.
To me, you mean?
to you, as we were trying to record it, and Gabe's been there as well. It was. I think we were talking about, actually going back here, this is what the notes here are, the show notes. Here you go, from August 14, 2007, our first ever podcast. This is what they call a pilot in the industry. Things may change between this episode and the next, i.e. We may have different people on the panel, we'll have better audio quality, and we may even try and get some theme music. In this podcast, we talk about the Pope's motu proprio, a Catholic town, and ponder on the question, is New Zealand a Christian society? So, ooh, not much has changed in 10 years because we're pretty much still talking about those topics.
The last one, anyway. Yes, certainly the last one.
Yes, indeed. But 10 years, 118 episodes plus all the other shows that we've had on the network over the years as well. And it all started with those humble beginnings. I think we're getting close to around 180,000 downloads of all time, which, you know, for a little podcast here in New Zealand, that's not too bad.
I thought it was more than that.
Is it? Well, I was looking at the stats the other day. 180,000 wasn't more than that.
Oh, maybe that's just for 15 Station.
Oh, yeah. That's what I wasn't looking at the whole network.
I can not there. Shows on the other, yeah.
No. But, I mean, it's good. And we appreciate all of your contributions over the years. Gabe's right there from episode one. I mean, you had a few leaves of absence.
Took a few off in the middle.
A few years in the middle, but came back for 10 years.
You can't have too much of a good thing.
In small doses. Small doses. And I mean, George, I know that you know, it's been 6 years since you've been on the podcast. So of course, you've been avidly listening to us ever since, I'm sure. I mean, we've had
constantly
writing in. But it is funny to think about it when you sort of look at, you know, how much all of our lives have changed over the last 10 years, and comparing how technology has changed, how the church has changed. You know, we've been through a couple of popes since then. Still have them alive, actually. And we've also had so many people join the podcast and partake over the years. It's all there. It's all there, available on the internet. Anna, you're one of our newer members, so you might have to like go back and listen in history.
I might, yes.
Not advisable to dig those early ones up.
Yeah, maybe skip that. Well, but we did get by the second one, we did live up to that promise. So by that point, I think it was playing that back to Joseph. Made him go, right, that's it. I'm going to have to sort you guys out with some decent audio quality and the theme music, which I still love listening to even to this day. We were recording there.
Stunned silence.
That's right. It was a bit difficult to say, really. And and Gabe's, we had to get the from Gabe's in there. So, you know, this is a classic. This is high quality. 10 years of high quality Catholic audio, really. But with that, I suppose we should probably wrap things up. So thank you, everyone, for listening. If you do want to find those that back catalogue of episodes, you can go check them out at our website, www.station15.co.nz. We might see a spike of downloads for some of those earlier episodes. But they're all available going right back when. If you'd like to reach out and have a chat to us, we always love to hear from you. You can drop us an email to podcast@station15.co.nz, or you can find us on twitter.com/station15 or facebook.com/station15. I think that's everything. 10 years later, you figure I'd have the plug sorted by now, but not really that much. Thanks so much. Where should we start with? George, thank you. Thank you so much for dialing in from the other side of the world. Early in the morning there. And we really appreciate it. It's great to talk to you again. It's great to have you back on the podcast.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure. It's nice to join in.
It's brilliant. And Gabe's, it's been a while since we've had you. Not as long as it's been since George, but it's been a while since we've had you. So thanks very much for figuring out how to use Skype again. It's been great having you on the podcast as well, mate. Thank you very much.
Thank you for including me in the 10-year anniversary, James. I'll look forward to the next one in 10 years' time.
Just think about the technology will be in 10 years' time.
Yeah.
What's that?
We should just take a break. We'll take a break for 10 years and then just resume at the 20th and just like have a hologram or something. I don't know. We'll see where we're at that point. Virtual reality podcast. Anna, thank you so much. It's always great to talk to you. Thank you for being one of our newer hosts on the 15th station. It's always good to have you. Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. It's great to be part of the celebrations. And I did have a wee celebratory glass of wine before the before this podcast. So
it did sound like you were slurring a little bit earlier.
because we would normally, for those who would listen right back in the beginning, would know that the 15th station has always been a promoter of fine cuisine and balanced diets, which is why from the early days, it was all pineapple lumps and mint slices. If Father Roderick's listening, he'll remember. He was a little bit less impressed when I gave him some pineapple lumps when he was down in New Zealand. Chewy candy. They're a chewy candy that sort of don't even taste anything like pineapple. And then mint slices, which are a chocolate-covered biscuit that have a mint sort of cream in them. But it's kind of hard to do those virtually, Gavin. So I was expecting a care package from you, to be honest. And it hasn't arrived, so I'm a bit disappointed after 10 years. But
well, I had 11 mint sliced biscuits and a packet of pineapple lumps, so that makes you feel any better.
you'll spend the next like 3 weeks running that off, mate. Hey, we wouldn't have this podcast if it wasn't for you, Gavin. I want to just acknowledge and thank you for all the hard work you've put in over the years in producing this podcast. You've been on, I mean, basically every single one of them. And from those very early days, it's quite easy to have an idea sometimes, but it's very hard to get someone who will actually follow through and make it happen. And that's what you are. You've made this happen. So 10 years of this podcast, and I just want to thank you on behalf of all the rest of the 15th Station team for all the hard work that you've done over the years to keep this podcast going over a decade. There would be very few podcasts that have run for that long. I mean, we were right there at some of the early days, and we haven't really changed the format since those times. So that shows that you're on to a winner from the very beginning. So even with the distance of time and of people being on the other side of the world, you've still kept us going pretty much regular as clockwork. So thank you for all you've done, mate. We really, really appreciate it.
Thanks, James. And truly, it wouldn't have happened if it weren't for you nagging me like the parent with the dishes to say, let's do this. And yeah, it's amazing. It's 10 years ago. And it has been. It's, you know, it's been a journey. But in many ways, we are, you know, we've come a long way, but we haven't in so much as we were lucky, but we came across a formula that we think works, and that's why we haven't felt the need to change it. And indeed, we wouldn't be here, truly wouldn't be here without you, because I never would have even thought to start a podcast, let alone know what it was 10 years ago. So thank you for everything you've done. I think we've both missed one, or neither of us have missed more than two anyway. Those 10 years. So it's been great fun, and wouldn't have chosen anyone else to be along on the journey. Thanks, James.
Oh, what a good man. I'm going to get all choked up. Look, hey, thank you. And I'll tell you what, there definitely would be no podcast
if we didn't have you, our listeners. So thank you all very much, whether you've just started listening to this, our first episode in 10 years, or whether you've been listening since the very beginning, whether you're my wife who's finally figuring out how to use podcasts after 10 years. We want to thank you all for your support over the years, for your prayers, for the times you've written in and told us that you really enjoy what we're doing, for the times you've written and told us that you don't. It's been great to have listeners who have been wanting to share their faith with us, which is all we try to do on this podcast. And I mean, I guess the final thank you goes to the person who needs it the most, who needs it the least but deserves it the most. So we just give thanks and praise to God for the blessings of being able to get together over these 10 years in relative comfort and ease, especially as we've talked about some pretty heavy issues. And so I just sort of give thanks to God for everything he's done for all of us, that he's done for all of you out there. And until next time that we talk, hopefully not in 10 years time, hopefully sooner than that. But until then, take care and God bless.